Hello, everyone, and welcome to this presentation on embracing emotions. And my name is Deb Barnard, and I will be leading you, accompanying you through this journey, this investigation. So, embracing emotions. Let's have a little think about that. These are the aims and objectives for this session today. The overarching aim here is to enable us to feel more confident with emotional content. And as counsellors, as therapists, the chances are you're already pretty confident around emotions, but this is just hopefully a little bit of a deeper dive. So, how can we be more confident around emotions, both within ourselves and others? And a little bit of rethinking in terms of our relationship to our feelings, and then to take that into understanding. We've all got feelings, we all have emotions. So, what is the function? What is the purpose? Why did evolution give us such things? And once we understand more fully our emotional content, how can we work with those feelings? So there's our main aim and objectives for today. So our agenda is we will be thinking about your thoughts on emotions, having a little look at the difference between emotions, feelings, and mood. What are our feelings about feelings? What is the function of feelings? How can we listen to these feelings more effectively? How can we lean in instead of leaning away, which often we have a tendency to do? And how can we manage? How can we be alongside feelings, particularly difficult feelings, as comfortably as we are able? Quite a large chunk of this workshop is based on the work of Carla McLaren. And she wrote a great book called The Language of Emotion, The Language of Emotions. And it's a kind of quite a hefty book, and it reframes, hopefully, our attitude, particularly within the Western world, in terms of how we relate to emotions. So we're going to start off with a quote from her, and it's a pretty big claim. So, without our emotions, we can't make decisions. We can't discover our dreams. We can't set proper boundaries or behave skillfully in relationships. We can't identify our hopes, support the hopes of others, and we can't connect or even find our dearest loves. Huge claims, but interestingly, written in the negative. So I tried a wee flip here in terms of, if that's what we can't do, so therefore, what can we do instead? So, emotions can help us make decisions, help us discover our dreams, set good boundaries in relationships, identify our hopes, and connect to others. Quite compelling in terms of what Carla believes the function of emotions to be and what they can achieve. So, I'm just going to invite you right at the off here just to press pause just for a few minutes and to think about these following questions here. What is your relationship to your emotional self? How are you around your own emotional content? What do you believe can be challenging about our emotions in general? And why do you think we have emotions right at this stage at the off? And welcome back. Okay, so you've had a little bit of a chance there to warm up your own thinking about emotions. So we're just going to move on and consider what is then the difference between an emotion, a feeling, and a mood. Well, interestingly, it could be said, or some say, that the actual emotion is the visceral reaction that our body will have to a stimulus. So something happens and we can have an emotional response. And this can be almost chemical in terms of chemicals rising or neurological in terms of neurons firing. And this is our response, literally physically, to the stimulus that has occurred. At that stage, the emotional response is unnamed. And when we are able to name it, it becomes a feeling. That is how we make sense of that emotional reaction. We name it, and it is a feeling. And feelings can be personal, physical, and mental. And I say personal in that I could be feeling something. Say, for example, I'm going to a big party with a friend, and I could have certain things running through my body, like I could have a slightly faster heart rate, like I could be breathing a little bit more quickly, I could have slightly sweaty palms. And I might interpret those emotional responses as excitement. My friend could be feeling very similar, and she might interpret those emotional responses, for example, as feeling slightly anxious. So feelings are often quite personal to us and who we are. Mood. So what is a mood? Well, a mood is often what happens when emotions and feelings hang around, when they get stuck. And they often hang around, interestingly, when they're being ignored in some way. And we can find ourselves almost hijacked by quite a pervasive mood. So just to get our understanding between those three words, and emotions and feelings, that's their words that are often used interchangeably, and I will do so myself throughout this presentation as well. So Carla McLaren, one of the things she starts off with in terms of challenging is our language of emotion, the very title of her book. And she says in the Western world, we have a very poor language around our feelings. It's quite slim, it's quite basic. We kind of know happy, we kind of know sad, and then we sometimes often dry up beyond that point. And I'm sure you will be familiar with things like the feelings wheel, and there's lots of resources out there that helps expand that lexicon around feelings. It's a really lovely idea, particularly with parenting and with young people and children, to help them at a very early age expand that language, to have that mastery or that command to be able to describe with nuance what it is that we are actually feeling and they might be actually feeling. So here's some examples of some words for feelings. I'll just let you have a look there. Just to begin to get a sense of how nuanced they can be. So, thinking about your own feelings, we're going to take some of these basic emotions here: anger, sadness, fear, and joy. So, another press pause moment in that just gives some consideration to. What is your relationship to anger? How are you around your own anger? How are you around other people's anger? Are you better with your own than others? What are you like with sadness? What's your relationship there? How does fear appear in your life? And of course, joy. So just give yourself a few minutes just to explore those feelings and your relationship to them. Okay, thank you. So you've just given some thought around those words. And interestingly, Carla would say that in terms of our emotional content, we have a very poor relationship to our emotional selves. Again, I want to be quite specific here that this is in the Westernized world. And that what we tend to do is we favor our intellect and we favor our physicality. That's where we put energy and effort. And if we're lucky, we might also favor spirituality. but a really important part of who we are, our whole emotional content, on the whole, she reckons we have a very poor relationship with. And one of the first things we do that doesn't help that relationship is we begin to label those feelings as good or bad. And Carla would say there's no such thing as a bad feeling or a good feeling. She just completely eliminates that whole evaluation on top of the feelings. To be sure, we have some feelings that are much more comfortable to experience than others, but whether we need to then label them as being good or bad is a different matter. So let's have a little look at some of that in terms of the good feelings, traditionally, what might be seen as good. So the good, the bad, the ugly emotions. So we're familiar with those: happiness, joy, contentment, desire, love. And interestingly, in terms of the messages we receive from the world, most advertising or marketing is based on a promise of achieving these things. Buy that car and feel satisfaction. Eat that chocolate, feel desire. We're being sold this all the time. We're being sold these feelings as feelings to aspire to and to attempt to achieve in some way. So the bad feelings, what might they be? The sadness, the anger, the frustration, the fear, jealousy, shame, guilt. We're familiar with that list. To such a degree that some people would say when they read that list, you can end up feeling slightly anxious in response to just what's there on the screen. And on the whole, we try to avoid feeling like this. We try to get away from. And if you think about it, if you think about it in terms of the medical model, we've developed some form of medication for nearly every quality in that bag. So that isn't necessarily dealing with our emotional selves. It's kind of erasing our emotional selves. It's numbing our emotional selves. It's blocking, which sometimes is really important. We might need to do that to give ourselves a bit of a break. But on the whole, Carla would say, what would it be like if we didn't view these emotions as bad, if we could lean into them? And it reminds me, in a sense, of when I was a child. I think I was allowed two emotions. I was allowed happy and quiet. And I kind of know quiet isn't an emotion, but it seemed to me most adults around me seemed to be most comfortable with me if I was just quite content and happy and getting on with things and not making too much of a fuss in the world. If I felt any of these other things, so if I felt anger or frustration, then I was often told to just go away until you've calmed down. Go to your room and come back down when you're not feeling angry anymore. So they were often tried to be closed down. Even if I got upset, then most adults around me would try to stop those tears as quickly as possible, as if the aim was to try and turn off that tear tap in a way. So as we grow up, if that has been our style of parenting, or we've witnessed everything that we might see on TV in terms of marketing and advertising, we're getting very strong messages that we shouldn't have these emotions, that in some way we should avoid them. But what if we viewed them in a slightly different way? And this is where Carla does the reframe. She tries to flip our relationship to our emotional selves, particularly what we deem to be the more negative emotions. And she believes they all have a function and they act as messengers. In some way, they are attempting to communicate with us. Evolution has given us them. And so, therefore, surely they have a positive function in our life. So, let's have a look at some of the ways in which she might view some of these more traditionally negative emotions and how she sees them. So she sees fear as our personal trainer, which I think is a lovely way to think about fear. Fear isn't there to completely just terrify us. Fear is asking something of us. It's asking us to get into a state of readiness in some way. It is drawing attention to something that we might need to do. So if you think about fear and young people, or you couple fear with anxiety, like say exams are coming up and somebody is saying that they feel scared about those exams. Well, on one way, we could say you're meant to, you're supposed to. Of course, you're going to feel anxious. There's high stakes on those exams. They're important. So what is fear asking of you in that moment? Unfortunately, what we might do is say, I don't want fear, so I might get some medication that helps me with my anxiety to quell it, and then I carry on with my path toward my exams. But have I found that state of readiness, that state of preparedness that might quieten my fear anyway? So she sees fear as our personal trainer. Anger. It's one of my favorite quotes from Carla, and she says that anger walks the parameters of our soul looking for breaches. And I love that. It's our personal sentry, it's our personal guard. And I love that image of anger just walking the parameters of my soul. Gandhi loved anger. Gandhi thought he described his own anger as rocket fuel for action. But he was incredibly respectful. He knew it could be abused, and he knew it could also be dangerous if it wasn't worked with well. But for him, it literally was his rocket fuel because of his anger at the world in terms of injustice. Sadness. What might the function of sadness be? She sees this as fundamentally a healer. Something needs to be healed. So all these emotions, all these feelings somehow are attempting to communicate with us. And this is interesting in terms of how we might work with clients. And the more able we are to engage with our own emotional selves with courage and conviction, the more able I think we are to be able to hold that space for others who might be feeling really uncomfortable about their fear, their anger, their sadness, or their anxiety. And if we can just hold that space with confidence, then hopefully somebody else can hold their own emotional space with growing confidence. In terms of working with these emotions, she has some questions when they rise. So the question for fear, the question from the personal trainer could be, what action do I need to take? What do I need to change here? How can I find this state of readiness? What do I need to do? When anger rises, she might well ask, what must be protected here? What needs to be restored? And similarly, with sadness, the questions are along the lines of what must be released? What do I need to let go of? What needs to be refreshed? And she has similar questions for all the different emotions that we might feel. Now, shame is something that isn't a nice feeling to have. But again, if we start to reframe our relationship to shame, assuming it's ours, not shame that we might be carrying from other people, etc., then what might the message be behind shame? Well, if I'm feeling shame, then I need to consider, what have I just done that I'm now feeling a bit shameful about? And that's showing me something. I've crossed a line there. I'm not comfy with how maybe I've just behaved. And it gives me an opportunity to think about it and to choose a different path next time that might arise. Guilt. Guilt and parenting, for example. I always remember my sister saying, as soon as you give birth to a child, you give birth to guilt too, as a parent. And you could be riddled with, oh, I feel really guilty. I should have spent more time. I should do this. I should have done that. I wish I hadn't. And we can wallow in that, or we can listen to that guilt and say, okay, how can I help alleviate that? What do I need to do differently? So, in effect, it can almost sharpen our mindfulness around our own parenting practice. So her overarching request here is, how can we honor our emotions? And some of these questions you might wish to use in your clinical work, but if you can almost encourage this relationship to emotional self rather than the aim being to get rid of certain emotions, then ideally, hopefully, you create or you help encourage, I guess, a more rounded approach to emotions and feelings and our very sense of self and who we are. So just imagine in terms of upbringing. So I've just described before what I believe my upbringing was like, and I don't think that's too dissimilar to many other people's, but then that could be an age thing as well. So how else could we work with emotions, particularly with young people? So here's an example of maybe a little kid that has lost their favorite kite, their best kite ever. Fantastic. They loved it. They loved it. And it got snatched by some wind and blew away. And here are some of the responses, some of the traditional responses that might happen. So we've got a pretty brutal response just to kick off with, which is stop crying, essentially. And even worse, there we've got don't be a big baby. And particularly maybe around gender, we might say different things about tears. And I often feel absolutely heartbroken sometimes for boys and young boys in terms of how often they have to swallow their feelings. And that don't be a big baby if you're crying, because big boys don't cry. You might try a distraction technique. Come on, let's go and get an ice cream. So let's think of something that's nice in that moment that we can do. So hopefully you just forget about the fact that you've just lost your kite. You could try some bribery. Don't worry, we'll get an even bigger kite. We'll get a better one. You'll love it even more. But what if we leaned in with that little one? What if we simply were alongside that sadness and we acknowledged what somebody was feeling with the, do you know what? It's really, really sad when we lose something that we love. And that happens sometimes. So we're not pretending it doesn't. We're absolutely acknowledging the feeling and we're acknowledging it with empathy because we've got that sense of, yes, that's a hard one to hold. It's a hard one to feel. And then we might offer some comfort. Would you like a big hug? So we've not closed it down. We've not demanded it stop. And we've not bribed, we've simply leaned in. And ironically, what can often happen is when that little person feels acknowledged, when that little person feels heard, and when the emotion feels heard, then what we're hopefully doing is we're enabling that person to manage their emotional selves more and more as they grow up. And we're also around the emotion in a way that we're not showing fear. We're able to be alongside it with steadiness. And that, again, what message are we given there? So this whole thing about naming the emotion and leaning in towards us, leaning in toward it, how might that happen? What's useful there? Well, there's an experiment that was done. Very much so to look at exactly that in terms of the different ways that we might handle, say, for example, fear. I have to give a bit of a trigger warning. I'm going to put a slide up that's got a big spider on the screen. So you might wish to look away if they're not your thing. So here we go. And this is essentially what the experiment was. So they had 88 people that they knew had a fear. Often a phobia of spiders. They absolutely didn't like them, terrified of them. And they had 88 people and one big hairy live tarantula. And the tarantula was in a Perspex box in an outdoor space on a table. And the whole group of people were invited to approach the spider and to see how close they could get and whether they were close enough to even touch it. And people, their physiological responses were then monitored. They were asked to do this 3 times. So the first time they did it, the instruction was simply try and get as close as you can to the spider in the box on the table. The second time, the spider was indoors, and the group was split into four. Group one was asked to walk towards the spider, so just do exactly the same thing, but interestingly, be very factual about what is happening. So describe out loud what that is like and what you're feeling. Say it out loud. So I'm walking towards the spider. It looks absolutely gross. It's got big hairy legs with orange bits on. I'm not liking it at all. My heart's going. My hands are sweating. I'm feeling really scared. Say it all out loud. The second group was asked to reassure yourselves in some way. So things like, don't worry about the spider. It's most probably got no poison in it because it's an experiment. It's in a box. It can't get out. It can't do anything to me. It can't hurt me. So try and reassure yourself about the spider and the reality of that situation. The third group were asked to simply ignore. Don't even acknowledge the spider. Don't even acknowledge what you're doing. No reassurance, nothing. Talk about something completely different, like a film you saw. What was it like? And then, of course, the fourth group was the control group. They were just invited to approach the spider and do or say nothing. So, a question. When it came to the third time the group were invited to go towards the spider, they were back in the first condition, which was outdoors, and the physiological responses were measured. Which group do you think had improved their relationship toward the spider and lessened the fear? The chances are you might well have said group one, the group that said it out loud. And interestingly, we put more energy into group two. We put a lot of energy into attempting to reassure one another. And ironically, that can actually up our fear response because there's something to reassure somebody about. So there must be something quite scary going on there if somebody is putting energy into reassuring me. So ironically, the reassuring group then can have exactly the opposite response in terms of trying to bring that fear down. So it was actually group one, as you most probably guessed, that actually did experience a drop in their fear response to the spiders. And it was simply talking that out loud. So building on that, have a little think. If we develop a different relationship to our emotions, another press pause moment, and think of an emotion that you have felt recently. And first off, can you describe how you were feeling? If that emotion was a friend, so we're attempting the reframe here, how do you think it is trying to help? So I don't believe, and I don't think Carla believes, that emotions are trying to harm us or they're trying to hurt us, even though they're uncomfortable. Part of that uncomfortableness is to gain our attention, but they're not deliberately trying to wound in any way. So if we saw that difficult emotion as a friend, what would it be doing to try and help? What's the message? And if I can put my finger on that, does that open up my options? And when I've honored that emotion, when I've leaned into that emotion rather than lean out or try to remove it, ignore it, or bury it, what will I do now? What have I learned? And that can be the process of simply how to work with an emotional response. And there is something about ignoring our emotions that when we do, when they do feel ignored, they get louder or they leak out in different ways. They don't disappear. Just because we bury them, it doesn't mean they're gone. They will feel almost unsatisfied in some way because they've not been acknowledged. So if you'd just like to press pause and give some thought to that sequence of questions. Okay, welcome back. So here's an example of how I might work with an emotion I'm feeling based on those questions there. I'm feeling a lot of anger, let's say, for example, toward my flatmate. And I'm feeling angry because it seems to me that I'm the one that ends up kind of cleaning the kitchen mainly. And they tend to leave it in a bit of a mess. So I'm asking myself, what is that emotion trying to say to me? I know I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling all discombobulated, I'm feeling unsettled, and I'm possibly feeling a little unappreciated too. It's kind of reminding me about my own values and what's important to me and how I like to be in the world. The thing about me feeling unappreciated, I don't know whether that's true or not. I most probably have added that bit on. I've made that assumption. It's reminding me about what I believe in and what I think is important. So now I kind of know that. Now I kind of know that it isn't necessarily about me being unappreciated. Then what are my options here? Well, I could let it go. Is it the end of the world? Can I just relax my own response too? Can I check in with my flatmate about how I am actually feeling? Can I investigate whether that's true? Or could I make a request? And I say a request. I can't make a demand. I can just make a request. And if I make a request, I have to be happy to hear a yes or a no. My request could be, could you help look after the kitchen in the same way I do? Somebody might not be able to do that. So it could be over to me to shift my response to. And actually, I might decide at the end, let it go, let it go. It's not the end of the world. So I've worked with my anger. I've taken it through a process, and hopefully by the end of it, it slightly subsides. It subsides. It's done its job. That's not always possible in terms of when we might feel overwhelmed. And this is what feelings do in terms of sometimes they can flood us out. And simply, that is literally, if you can imagine water rising in your brain, that's almost what is happening when we have an emotional overwhelm, an emotional flooding. It comes from our amygdala, which is kind of in the middle of the brain, a bit down. And it's one of the oldest parts of the brain. And that's where our fight, flight, freeze resides and our emotional responses. The newer part of our brain is here. This is our prefrontal cortex. This is where our sensibleness is. This is where our intellect is, hopefully. And what happens is there's more neuron directions going from amygdala to prefrontal cortex than there are the other way. Because sometimes it's important that we don't think about things, that we react really quickly. So it's almost as if the emotional flooding wants to turn off that part of the brain. And you might have heard this when people say things like, I just saw red. I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't think straight. Then that's when we are in that moment of feeling flooded. And what can we do to help that, to re-engage this part of our brain, to enable us to work with the emotion and to move out of that space? And here are some resources that I'm sure many of you will feel familiar with, but you can always Google them a little bit more if not. The first thing is, can you press your pause button? Simply bang, press pause. Be in that moment. Notice that moment. Can you pull in your tarantula strategy? Can you name out loud what you are feeling? What's going on in you at that moment in time? Very simply, this brings This re-engages our prefrontal cortex. And when our prefrontal cortex is re-engaged, it helps the chemicals with the amygdala almost in a way begin to subside. That's what we're looking for. We've heard the message, we've heard the thump, and then we're bringing this part back of our head in order for us to begin to think about those feelings. And this is what naming them does. We know how to do that within therapy and counseling. There's a lot of work around people being able to describe their feelings. Box breathing. I'm sure you'll be familiar with box breathing. It's when you kind of breathe in for four, you breathe out for five, breathe in for four, breathe out for five, or whatever numbers. But the key is to breathe out longer than when you breathe in. So if you think about it, when we're stressed, when we're shocked, when we're worried, when we're anxious, our breathing goes shallow and it goes quicker. And we tend to breathe like this. We're trying to get lots of oxygen in, apparently. When we're relaxed, what do? We tend to sigh. So we might go, oh, at the end of the day, all that, letting it out. And this kind of tricks the parasympathetic nervous system into thinking that we're entering a state of relaxation. So the key is to try and get that out breath longer than the in breath and to slow that feeling down. And I'm sure you're familiar with this one. This is the five senses exercise, which enables us to be mindful of the moment and the environment we're in. It's slightly a distraction technique, but again, it's giving the amygdala a chance to subside so we can work more effectively with what's going on. And it's quite simple. You invite somebody to think of five things that they can see, and then four things that they can touch, three things that they can hear, two things they can smell, and one thing that they can taste. So you're engaging all the senses and bringing a different level of awareness into that moment. Very useful thing just to do on one's own as well. Or you can just simply describe five favorite things. Interestingly, if you're angry, it says they do some maths. And many years ago, I used to do some anger management work with young people and little kids, well, kids old enough to be able to do maths. And what I kind of discovered, and what the little kids often said to me, is they didn't like it when they got angry. They weren't comfy, and they felt almost out of control. They hadn't learned yet how to manage those moments. And most of the time, people were just telling them to stop doing that moment, but they hadn't learned how to work with or to regulate that moment for themselves. And I remember one little boy ended up with a little notebook, his own little pencil. And when he felt a fury coming on, which he absolutely knew he didn't like going into, then he would sit down in a quiet space, literally do some maths. And that would draw attention again away. The brain would go into that part of the mathematical bit, working something out again to give the amygdala a chance to subside. So there are just some examples of how you could work with overwhelming feelings and what you might choose to suggest to people that you're working with. So that's looking at being in the moment. What about thinking about anticipating, sort of planning in advance? And it's quite common to look at developing a personal well-being plan with people around feelings or emotional content, and to think ahead. What can have a negative effect on my mood? What are the signs that my mood might be changing? What helps me come out of that mood? What can I do? And what are my top three tips that might help that moment? And you could work with somebody just going through that plan and pulling in all the other things that we've looked at today. So we've looked at reframing emotions, getting rid of the good and the bad, and how we can more ably lean in to the preciousness of what it is that they might be trying to communicate. We've looked at what we can do in the moment when we feel flooded by and overwhelmed, and we've had a look at what we can do to preempt and anticipate our emotional landscape. So, just leave you with a slide here and asking this question: what are you feeling now? Thank you very much. And big thank you from me for your time today. For further links and resources, you can refer to the lecture delivery page below. And don't forget to claim your CPD certificate for this presentation. Thank you, everyone.